Welcome to New World Newts, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Can we get rid of our country's and our culture's militarism? We have to, but boy, it won't be easy. So says Stan Gough today, and 50 years ago, so said Martin Luther King. I hope you'll stay tuned. January is about over, and we shouldn't let the month go by without at least mentioning Martin Luther King. When I think of King's life, what sticks in my mind is not his struggles of the 1950s, early 1960s for integration, not the Montgomery bus boycott, not the letter from the Birmingham jail, not the I Have a Dream speech, not the struggle for voting rights, important as all those things were. What really impresses me, though, is when King went beyond those earlier struggles, when he saw that it wasn't enough to focus on voting rights and fair housing and integrated lunch counters. When he saw that Black Americans, and most white Americans too, would see little real improvement in their lives until they had beaten the twin 600-pound gorillas in the room. These twin gorillas are ruthless, exploitative American capitalism and the U.S. war machine. I call them twin gorillas. More precisely, they are twin gorillas joined at the hip. This is my metaphor, not King's, and I'm probably not being fair to gorillas. But to return to King, this broadening of his concerns came in the last year or so of his life. The change was marked by his great speech against the Vietnam War, given at Riverside Church, New York, on April 4, 1967. At the time, he was also working on organizing a massive Poor People's March on Washington, D.C. And what was he doing in Memphis on April 4, 1968, when he was assassinated? He was speaking in support of striking garbage collectors who were demanding a fair wage. In sum, not integrated lunch counters, economic justice, and an end to military aggression. When King took on the Pentagon and the rest of the national security state, and also took on the oligarchs of the economy, he quite lost the support of the white establishment. The establishment didn't really mind this non-violent Christian confronting the occasional Southern sheriff. Doing that didn't threaten the elite or hurt the Dow Jones average. And doing that did help draw oppressed black people away from the more radical and dangerous organizations, such as the Communist Party, the Black Panther Party, the Nation of Islam. So the white establishment didn't have any serious problems with King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference and its nonviolent demonstrations. But when King began denouncing the country's current war of choice and actively campaigning against wage slavery, well, that kind of nonsense is bad for the empire, bad for stock portfolios. So King was killed in short order. So in his last year, King opposed and confronted two major predators, predatory capitalism and the predatory U.S. war machine. The past 2 weeks, we've been hearing about capitalism. This week, then, let's focus on the war machine. We'll hear from former Special Forces Master Sergeant Stan Gough. First, though, let's hear from Martin Luther King himself. Here's about 4 minutes from his great anti-war speech at Riverside Church, April 4, 1967. This was 1 year to the day before his assassination. The speech is titled Beyond Vietnam. In this passage, King discusses why he, as a civil rights leader, was obliged to shift his gaze beyond voting rights and housing rights towards the broader problem of militarism and national priorities.
Tonight, however, I wish not to speak with Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, but rather to my fellow Americans. That is, at the outset, a very obvious and almost facile connection between the war in Vietnam and the struggle I and others have been waging in America. A few years ago, there was a shining moment in that struggle. It seemed as if there was a real promise of hope for the poor, both black and white, through the poverty program. There were experiments, hopes, new beginnings. And then came the build-up in Vietnam, and I watched this program broken and eviscerated, as if it was some idle political plaything of a society gone mad on war. And I knew that America would never invest the necessary funds or energies in rehabilitation of its poor so long as adventures like Vietnam continued to draw men and skills and money like some demonic destructive suction tube. So I was increasingly compelled to see the war as an enemy of the poor and to attack it as such. Perhaps a more tragic recognition of reality took place when it became clear to me that the war was doing far more than devastating the hopes of the poor at home. It was sending their sons and their brothers and their husbands to fight and to die in extraordinarily high proportions relative to the rest of the population. We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Holland. And so we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. And so we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village. But we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I could not be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor. My third reason moves to an even deeper level of awareness, for it grows out of my experience in the ghettos of the North over the last 3 years, especially the last three summers. As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. For the sake of those boys, for the sake of this government, for the sake of the hundreds of thousands trembling under our violence, I cannot be silent.
Martin Luther King, Jr., April 4, 1967. Let us move now from the past to the present, from Martin Luther King to Stan Goff. Goff was a career soldier from 1970 to 1996, a master sergeant in the U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets. He has also served as an instructor at the United States Military Academy. so he knows the army and he knows war about as well as anybody. He's a very sharp guy, and he seems to be a scholar, too. And he's become an analyst and a fierce critic of the militarism that pervades American society. For Goff, America's problem isn't just that the Pentagon has too much power and money. It's deeper than that. As Goff sees it, America has a national religion, worship of the nation-state. And in that religion, war is a central ritual. I'm tempted to say a sacrament. Not only in the U.S., but in Western countries generally. And this is nothing new. Goff traces the religion of the nation-state and its religious practice of total war back to the U.S. Civil War. So the problem is not just the Pentagon, it's our whole society. Many of our social institutions promote this religion of the nation-state and its sacrament of war. For example, the public school system, organized sports, especially football, Hollywood, the National Rifle Association, the Boy Scouts. For Goff, another cause of endemic militarism is our culture's warped concept of masculinity, which stresses violence. So many of our society's institutions are so closely intertwined with militarism that demilitarizing our society may be close to hopeless. So says Goff, and he's probably right. What he feels he can do is work with individuals, helping them critique what they see in the media, and especially helping them re-examine what masculinity means. That's pretty heady thinking for an ex-Green Beret. Quite a change in perspective. It's different in details, but also kind of similar to the change in thinking Martin Luther King underwent late in his life. Here is Stan Goff in a radio interview of April 2014. He starts out discussing why our culture venerates soldiers and veterans, why we call every guy who ever put on a uniform a hero.
I actually wrote a fairly substantial chapter in my last book, the one that's coming out, I think, around February, about when this started in the United States in particular, and it was back during the Civil War. Before that, people were very suspicious even of standing armies. And the Civil War, the American Civil War, was the first modern war, the first total war in a lot of ways. It was the first mechanized war. It was the first time that supplies were being moved by trains and communication was over the wires. And the first aerial reconnaissance balloons, the first submarines, the first armored battleships, all those things, the first time that machine guns were put into use, even though they were put into general use because of the smoke back then. But there, and it was the first total war that was waged against the entire society. It was understood that the whole population was at war against another whole population. So in many ways, the American Civil War was the first modern total war. And Harry Stout wrote about Funny Alter the Nation. It's a moral history of the Civil War. It's a very interesting book. Because what he shows is that here, a couple hundred years after disestablishment, after there was, you know, the end of Christendom, the end of the political power of the church in Europe and America, there was the emergence of the nation state as the political sovereign. And William Kavanaugh, a Catholic theologian, writes about this too. He calls it the migration of the holy. What happened was that the nation state in the Civil War became sacred. It became the civic religion. And it took on all the aspects of a religion. You know, we had speeches that were dripping with religious imagery. And it's sort of interesting that if you think about going back to, say, the year 100, 200, 300 prior to the Constantinian shift in the church, the person who was most honored in Christianity was a martyr, someone who's willing to die and willing to die for their faith. But with a civic religion, it's the person who's willing to die for their country. And that became not just willing to die for your country, but willing to kill for your country. And so that's, I think that underwrites the veneration a veteran, because there are plenty of people out there who take as many risks as veterans, more risk than most veterans. There are plenty of people out there that suffer from traumas as bad or worse than combat. There are plenty of people out there who contribute a lot more to society, but they're not venerated in the same way that veterans are. I mean, the reason that veterans are venerated that way is that the veneration of veterans becomes a veneration of war, and war is the fundamental organizing principle of the nation. So war becomes part of the national liturgy in this civic religion. And you see, it is almost an article of faith. And that's, I think, why there's this sense of sacredness about it. The sacrifice of the soldier becomes much greater than any other form of sacrifice. And there is an element of intimidation. You know, you're a heretic if you question this. If you don't participate in the veneration of veterans and the veneration of soldiers, you are an outcast, because you're seen in exactly the same way as a heretic was seen in the High Middle Ages. I think that has a lot to do with it. This notion of a civic religion is really an interesting lens to kind of view this through, and it makes a lot more sense of why, you know, we have these parades and these flag wavings and all this, we want to refer to every soldier, even if they were a flute and piccolo player in the Air Force band, as heroes. You know, that's where I think this stuff comes from. Ideology works in a peculiar way. It reproduces power at the same time that it conceals it. And the ideology of militarism is now more concealed. It's very difficult to convince people that we're a militaristic culture, because now that's no longer acceptable to call it that, even though it is that, we can't call it that. So there's that concealment aspect. But if you go back to the turn of the century, around the time of the rise of the popularity of Theodore Roosevelt, and around that time, there was a real crisis of masculinity, because the frontier had been conquered. So there was no place out for this masculinity to be proven. And that was actually one of Roosevelt's things. You know, they were afraid that citification, that the urbanization was making men weak. And there was actually a call for militarism. That was also the time when the United States was very aggressively seeking colonies. And the Spanish-American War was their first attempt to really reach out beyond their own borders and begin to establish colonial peripheries. So in that period, we see the ideology of militarism really taking hold, being promoted. And two of the things that it was promoted through, very intentionally at the time, now it just becomes kind of a recursive feedback loop between ideology and the culture. But at the time, this was very intentional, was that were public schools were developed on a Prussian military model, and they were designed to discipline the population and make them more adaptable to a militaristic culture. And the other thing was the promotion of sports, in particular football. Now, when Jack Johnson defeated a white opponent boxing, that Roosevelt actually called for the prohibition of boxing, because this was very much a white man's thing, this whole push to get through this crisis, or this so-called crisis of masculinity. But in fact, it was with the establishment of public schools, they also had military science, or what was then considered military science, which became ROTC, was integrated into the schools at the very beginning. And the administrative structure, the management structure, and the execution, the organization of classes themselves were all done on a military model that was adapted from Prussia. So it's been there all along, and do these things that were adapted from the military tend to promote an episteme of militarism? Of course they do, whether we recognize it or not, because we tend not to understand sort of the interpretive frameworks that we use, because since they are our interpretive frameworks, they seem natural to us. They seem like common sense. And that naturalization is one of the things that sort of conceals ourselves from ourselves, you know. But yeah, the school and sport definitely, and gun culture. After the Civil War, people became concerned that they had to fire 1,000 rounds to shoot one person. And so marksmanship became a big deal after that. And then an organization appeared to promote marksmanship that was very closely aligned with the military. It was called the National Rifle Association. And another thing, well, the NRA had another partnership at the turn of the century, and that was another organization that was designed to promote military virtues, and that was the Boy Scouts of America, which they actually adapted from the Boy Scouts of the United Kingdom. And they brought an advisor over from UK to help establish the Boy Scouts of America. So you had the NRA, you had the Boy Scouts, the NRA and the gun culture, you had Boy Scouts promoting bald militarism, you know, the same kinds of the uniforms and marching and earning awards and all that stuff was very militaristic, and football and public schools. So all those things together eventually became part of the culture, and these things, you know, ideology conceals power, but it also reproduces, and it started reproducing, it automatically reproduces those same virtues that are now identified as military virtues. You know, I think that's, it's very much in there, but it's not a conspiracy. It's just something that becomes self-organized. You know, society is a very complex thing, but it's also a thing that sort of runs under its own steam until something disrupts it. And so all these relationships become naturalized, and they end up setting up these same kinds of feedback loops between what we do and what we think and how we feel and how we understand things. And militarism is basically now in our social genetic code, for lack of a better analogy. A lot of people would love to know, how do we, whoever the we is, fix this, whatever this is, and I'm not altogether sure it can be fixed. It's my own little niche in all this and trying to figure out how to intervene, how to deliver that dislocative jolt to people's consciousness about this is through the issue of gender, because I think gender is what underwrites militarism at a deeper psychological level, at a psychological level that is mostly invisible because these interpretive frameworks are naturalized. They are something that seem like common sense. I'm just not really sure. I think we just have to keep chipping away at this, you know, in every way we can, and confronting this in any way we can. And I'm not at all confident that we, whoever we is, are going to fix it. War seems to be a way of life all over the world, and it has been for a long time, and it definitely does correspond to, well, to two things, and that's large-scale organization and patriarchy of any kind. War seems to be synonymous with those things in the evolution of various cultures. And now with weapons being available all over the world, it makes it much easier for people to try to settle their problems with armed conflict. But again, it's also partly because we're organized all over the world now as nation states. Modern nation states have one fundamental organizing principle in common, and that is the ability to defend their fixed borders. So war, or in the case of the more metropolitan nations, the ability to go beyond those borders and gain access to the inputs that they need in order to maintain their metropolitan way of life, which is done at the expense of global periphery. So it's built in. I mean, every time we start up our cars, every time we go to Walmart, every time we do, all of us are forced to be complicit because, again, the society is self-organized. We're forced to be complicit in myriad ways. The question then becomes, how do we find ways to withdraw step by step from our own complicity? And I'm not sure I have an answer for that beyond local solutions, because it seems like the big global problems have such mass and inertia now that even world leaders are only pretending to be in control. I think they themselves are captured by this inertia. And I'm just not sure. I'm not sure if there is like a magic wand we can wave over this and make it all go away. So I guess what I do is just try to appeal to people one person at a time. Men in particular, that's my little shtick, is men in particular, take a look at yourselves and see how many ways you're motivated by this probative masculinity that associates masculinity with violence and conquest. If we can get men to think more about that, then at least some men will learn how to not participate in those structures. And I think that's probably the best we can hope for. I think probably more valuable than turning our back on them would be for people to engage in more astute cultural criticism. Because going to one of these cinema nines or whatever, and 7 out of the 9 films will have a man with a gun and a fireball in the background up on the marquee. I mean, it's very much a cultural thing. But since we're going to be exposed to it anyway, we need to be exposed to it in a way that we learn how to be critical about it. And cultural criticism is very, very important. Susan Jeffords wrote an essay some years ago, back at the beginning of the Iraq War, called Telling the War Story. And she showed how by turning these things into stories about individuals, we can avoid looking at the larger structural issues that reproduce war. Right now, the war is not something that is being produced for the same reasons now as it was 2,000 years ago. It's a different structure that's reproducing war. It's a different kind of war. So we don't want to essentialize war and then put it beyond our critical intervention. But by turning it into a story about individuals, I just want to forget what the name of it is, The Last Survivor or something that came out recently, was full of pathos, you know, because it was about this titanic struggle of this one individual to get through this terrible ordeal, and, you know, it made him very heroic. But by pulling our focus onto that war story, where we have the pathos of the individual character inside a story, it redirects our attention away from the structural conditions. It redirects our attention away from why was this person here in the first place? You know, what are the underlying historical trajectories that underwrite the war? Why did the United States feel like it had to invade Iraq? Why have we shifted since the Cold War all our attention to Southwest Asia and China? Why is all that stuff going on? People start asking those questions. Then power can be in trouble, or a little more trouble than they're in right now, because then we begin to see what their true motives are. And I think that's the main thing that's concealed by ideology, are the true motives and the true reasons for why things are the way they are. I would like to see a constant and relentless deconstruction of just one particular genre of film, and that's the male revenge fantasy. It's the most insidious genre, in my opinion, and it's probably one of the most popular. But the male revenge fantasy, if every time a male revenge fantasy came out, we had an explosion of cultural criticism and an explosion of deconstruction around what was going on with that, I think it would open people's eyes. Why do we as an audience participate in it? Why do we cheer when Indiana Jones shoots the guy with the sword and casually walks away as if this man's life is worth nothing at all? Why does that become comic relief for the tension in the film? Why is that? That deconstruction would be very helpful.
Stan Goff on why we need to end militarism and why it's so hard for us to do so. For Goff's words, thanks to Michael Welch, the Global Research NewsHour, and Station CKUW in sunny Winnipeg. I have condensed and edited the original recording. And thank you, too, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, we're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum. Remember that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and please come back again next week. Ciao.